2013 Monroe City Council meeting, and at this time we call the meeting to order and ask Edie to take roll call, please.
Councilperson Garing.
Here.
Cuddaback.
Here.
Williams. Camp. Davis. Gamble.
Here.
Hanford.
Here.
And Student Representative Perano.
Okay, I am aware that Councilmember Williams is in Arizona and will not be here tonight. Did receive word that Councilmember Camp will be a little later this evening. Not sure where Councilmember Davis is. Anybody here? No? Okay. And then Student Representative Brandon Hirano has a game that they play with sticks and balls and nets or something like that. Lacrosse.
I didn't say it.
What is it?
Yeah.
So we'll look for Councilmember Camp and Councilmember Davis. All right, please join me for the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
All right. First, this evening is an opportunity for citizens to bring their comments and viewpoints to City Council. It's your opportunity to speak on any issue except any quasi-judicial matter subject to a public hearing. We would like to ask that anyone who speaks this evening offer your name and address for the record and limit your time to 5 minutes. I don't have anyone signed up. A few folks in the... Any takers tonight? No? All right. Okay. No comments from citizens this evening, so we'll move on. Councilmember Gearing.
Thank you. For our study session topics, I do have an item that I'd like to at least consider adding based on email we got today to our agenda tonight. Can we just keep the business in action up when we may or may not consider that this evening? I don't want to hold up the rest of the discussion that we already have on the agenda, just trying to figure out what would be the most appropriate way to, we're talking about changing the agenda anyway, just so it's just one kind of a meeting, which of course would be easier, but the way that the list is tonight is we have one or the other. So if we were just to put it on one section, I'm not sure the appropriate way to do that.
Well, why don't we leave the business and action items open? Attorney Lell likes a motion to add items to the agenda, so if you would like to do that, we can add the item if there's a second and it's approved. So if you'd like to add...
I would move to include a discussion of the rent flex contract on our agenda with potential, I guess potential action.
Second of the first motion. All right. The motion has been made by Councilmember Garing, seconded by Councilmember Hanford, related to red flex with potential action.
Yeah, I mean, that's fine to put that at the end. I mean, we have the other items that are already on the schedule, so
we'll need to add potential action so that we, if we get through all these, we have given notice that something might take place, and so anyone in the audience who wants to stick around me.
Perfect. I appreciate it.
Okay. Councilor Gamble.
Yeah, I'm going to be voting again. I'm more than happy to discuss something, but anything with action I don't feel comfortable with unless it's actually on the agenda for all to see. So if we want to just discuss it, I'm fine. But if potential action is a part of the motion, then I'm going to vote against.
I appreciate that.
Thank you.
All right. Well, with that, there is the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Okay. The motion does fail. You want to make a motion to add something as a discussion item?
I move to make a discussion item. Red flex contract. That'll be the end of the agenda.
Okay.
Second.
And the motion is made to add the discussion item regarding red flex. End here, so it'll be we'll just add it to study session topics number 4.
That'd be great.
All right. And motion is made by Councilmember Gearing and seconded by Councilmember Hanford. But the record also showed that Councilmember Davis has entered the chambers. All right, all those in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you. Okay, so we don't have any business and action items this evening. We will recess the meeting here at 7:09 and reconvene in study sessions. And the first topic this evening is sign code. And I believe Mr. Appel has provided some information for this evening. So, Paul, thank you. How are you?
Good. Thank you. I'm really pleased to be here tonight. We've been working on the sign code for some time, and I'm really excited to bring this to you for for an introduction. We started this a little over a year ago. And I recognize Jeff Sachs. He's been in this from the very beginning. Mark and I, Cameron, spent several months on this. And we've hired Tom Beckwith, a consultant who's been instrumental in helping us pull all this together in this new code, this new format, and these updates. I'd like to just make a few comments, touch on a few things, and then ask Tom to give you a little more detail about what we've done with this code. I should note that I know you like to have redline versions of this code or code amendments, but we decided to give you a clean version because literally a redline version would be 90% red, in a large part because one of the innovative things Tom has done is take most of that text, that narrative in paragraph form, and convert it to a table. So instead of taking several minutes to find a hidden sentence in the code, you can look at the table and very quickly find the information you're looking for. This code is so much more user-friendly, understandable, much more clarity. It's all those things that we came out of the ad hoc committee with last spring with a wish list of things to change or improve in this code. But I wanted to touch based on a few key points what this code is bringing. There was no structural defects in the old code or current code. It was just cumbersome and needed some updating and certainly needed some reorganization and some reforming so it's better understandable and better used. But there's quite a bit of material in this new code on digital signs. Tom will talk more about this, but this is a trend. It's not just a trend. It's a evolving change in signage. We've accommodated or brought in the ability to off-premise signs, which we do not have now. So, for example, we talked about it some time ago when there was an image of up on Highway 2 in Kelsey, I think, where, say, Galaxy Theaters or an off-highway business, Emerald City, could have a presence on a multi-tenant off-premise sign on Highway 2. Somebody doesn't see it. We've adjusted, in many cases, increased some of the sign area requirements or maximums to be a little more flexible on size and so forth. Sandwich signs. We talked a lot about sandwich signs. Call for some restrictions on where these can be because they tend to proliferate. So we're being very specific about what we're proposing to allow sandwich signs. Did some work with the mixed use neighborhoods in crafting some different details for each of those areas. And the downtown sign guidelines remain in place in the code. We'll continue to use those. But when we adopt this new code, we will come back and undo the North Kelsey sign guidelines. Back when we were making those North Kelsey changes, we talked about leaving that sign guideline section in place until we got this new code. Now, when we do adopt this new one, we'll undo the North Kelsey, clean that up. Lastly, a word about enforcement. It's our hope to, once this is adopted, that we begin enforcement. We'll have there's a 10-year grace period, I'll say, for certain signs, an industry standard, non-conforming signs, and on things like sandwich signs for some of those miscellaneous prevalent illegal activities, we want to allow about 6 months to get the word out, to let people know what's in this new code, do some public education, so forth, and try and work with folks to begin to shrink that problem, and then really start some enforcement and treat everyone equally and consistently and enforce and, you know, really implement this new code. I think it's a much, much improved over what we have now. I'd like to ask Tom to give you a little more detailed look on this. Do you have any questions for me at this point?
I see no lights.
Appreciate the interview. Thank you.
Great.
Thanks, Paul. When we do these, we say there's really two objectives. One is style and one is substance. And the purpose of style is to make things as easy as possible. And what we find in a lot of ordinances that were written maybe 10 or 15 years ago is they're very long on language and very short on illustrations. And that's even more typical of sign codes. So a lot of what we did was move things into tables, as Paul said. So instead of having text trying to describe heights and sizes and so on, and doing it repetitively, it's much easier just to put that in a table and then put the numbers in the table that relate to the size or the height or the placement. And if possible, do things by footnotes rather than doing them in text. And there's two reasons for that. Not only is it easier to use, but it's also easier to amend. And what we find in a lot of cases is once you bury things in text and then you want to change anything, your risk is, are you going to be redundant through your ordinance and then miss something? And that's what we usually find in a lot of the ordinances. You add things, you change things, and so on. Because it's text-based, then you end up with contradictions and redundancies. And the other thing we try to use is graphics. And we incorporate in this some design guidelines because it's a lot easier to illustrate what you're trying to achieve than trying to write out text saying this is, you know, our objective and our goals. And one of the issues you'll find if you go through the design guidelines is there's as many rules broken on good signs as there are rules that are followed on bad signs. And so the essence is to put a good example in front of the sign industry and in front of businesses and say, this is what we're trying to achieve, do that or better. And then the third thing that we do is lots of times these ordinances are originally written to define a sign and then you try to apply where the sign should be. But most people, when they come in and they want to put signs on their buildings or their properties, the first thing they identify is the zoning district. So everything is organized by zoning district. And that means as you go through, you may find redundancies in the signs through different zoning districts. But as you do that, it says a freestanding sign, it's going to be different as you go through each district as to how it's placed or what its size is or what its purpose. The other thing we do in this process is do an inventory of what your existing sign conditions are. And the first 5 or 6 pages of your design guidelines are an inventory we took of your existing signs, what to characterize. What was typical, say, the downtown versus SR2 versus some other areas. And the key clutter that we saw there was not necessarily the permanent signs. It was the sandwich signs, it was the portable signs, it was the banners, it was the balloons, it was that type of material. And if that were eliminated or at least managed, you wouldn't have as much, quote, visual clutter as from your permanent signs as what you get from that. And the last thing is to keep up with technology. Paul alluded to the fact that digital, and not just digital, but digital with motion, is becoming increasingly the kind of advertising sign of the times. If you ever remember movies like Blade Runner and the scenes they had of L.A., that's where we're headed if we're not careful. Your current code doesn't speak at all to digital, doesn't speak at all to motion activated and so on. And when you don't speak to it, it's, quote, allowed. And you have digital signage already in town. And the key question was to address it front on and take up what some of those issues are. Now, the industry is somewhat undefined about what's good and bad, or say dangerous about digital signs as far as what the distractions are. But we use some of the most recent industry findings about how long those should be phased, how quickly they should be motion activated and so on. And they're pretty standard definitions of the ones used by the feds. They're the ones being promoted by some of the bigger cities who have more experience with it.
But what we recommend is you put this in place and then 6 months from now revisit some of the details to make sure you're comfortable that they're being applied as you intended. Now, our process is pretty simple. When we do the style, we transfer your existing code, no changes at all, into the format. So one of the tables I think Paul gave you was the table of what your existing ordinance is. And one of the issues as we got into it, on that table you see a lot of gray boxes. That's because your ordinance didn't fill in what they were. So in some cases you had 5-foot setbacks defined as most signs, and then later on in your existing ordinance you would talk about signs and there'd be nothing at all about setbacks. But presumably they were 5-foot from property lines. So in the gray boxes we filled in, assuming this is what your ordinance meant to say, it just didn't call it out. So we did everything into that table format. We moved things into the graphic format. We removed the redundancies now that we had tables and graphics to do that. And then previewed that with the Planning Commission, began then developing a list of things to address. And the things we addressed then became the final table and the final design guidelines. And we can go through them. But one of the things that's hardest to assess are signs in the abstract, heights and sizes. So for that, we created attachment 2, which is a part of your ordinance. And the first part of this attachment shows you defining what some of your basic signs are down in here, and then illustrating them on a typical kind of older building, and using some of the formulas in your proposed code. So if you're looking at a sandwich of about 8 square feet, that's a sandwich sign right here, it'd be about 8 square feet in scale. If we're proposing that windows have 20% opaqueness and 20% transparent, that's how we drop those approximate sizes into the windows. If you're looking at projecting signs of being 20 square feet, that's a box scale to 20 square feet. So it's much easier to look at these graphically and then get some sense of what's appropriate. Next. We did the same thing with example signs in the general commercial and service commercial to show what the sizes and the heights are. Currently, you're about at 35 feet, and 35 feet is about average in most ordinances and most current ordinances. But a lot of the newer ordinances in newly developing areas, they're coming lower and lower because where you're aiming more at the pedestrian and directly to the car. The question on height really becomes what kind of road you're operating on here and how long does it take you to visualize and figure out what the sign is trying to say. And 35 feet seems to be about average for a 35 mile an hour to 40 mile an hour road. If you're on a freeway and you're 60 miles an hour, the sign's got to be bigger because it takes that long to cognitively figure out what it says. And 100 square feet was the size that the Planning Commission settled on. This isn't a freestanding. This is also a freestanding. It's called a monument or a pedestal sign. And actually, you can see a lot more of the newer stores according to this. This is Best Buy and this is Home Depot, because when it's down on the ground, it actually looks bigger than when it's floating up in the air. And this is what the equivalent area would be if we lay up on a wall, 200 square feet. Now, by the way, you have a formula of 1.5 square feet to 1 linear feet of building, and that's about average, too, in the industry. Next. This is what it would be for a multi-tenant, and here you're actually giving a little more space because you're putting more tenants in it. So we're going up to 150 on the freestanding, and we're going up to 300 on the building components. And if you drive SR2, you'll see a lot of these signs pretty much within that category. Now, how these are divvied up is really up to the owner and the tenants. Your issue is this is the maximum size that you have to deal with, and it's up to you guys to figure it out. Next. This is an example of an off-premise multi-tenant, and your issue here was in the North Kelsey area, you have some major anchor tenants, and they're not on SR2, and they don't have visibility on SR2. So this would allow this kind of transfer, if you want, of a multi-tenant advertising sign out to SR2. But we put two things in the formula. It has to be 100 linear feet from any other sign, and it has to be composed of that square footage you're allowed on site. You're not getting more, you're getting the same thing, you're just simply allowed to put it in a different place. Now, there are a few places that we allow these, and these are mainly the intersections on SR2 where there are signals and there are major business activities off SR2. That would be up to the property owners and the commercial tenants to figure out how they would abide by these rules. But this would allow this opportunity, and in some cases, what we expect is some of the off-premise tenants would want to come and do this, and in so doing, they would want to consolidate some of the signs that are on SR2 in order to fit in this formula, and so it could actually decrease clutter rather than increase it. At least that's the theory. As I said, visit again in 6 months. Next. The last was the issue of limited highway signage, and particularly 202, and mainly at Main Street where the car dealership is. And one of the issues here is not only the size of the sign, but its height. And the Planning Commission settled about 140 square feet, and more than likely that would be a digital sign, which is a big digital sign, as opposed to a flat surface image. And the issue on the height is that this is approximately the elevation you're at it at 522, and you see if you're lower than this, you're just going to be staring you right in the face, or it's going to be below that image area. So we're going to settle on 45 feet as being an approximate height, and that's pretty much average for limited highways inside urban areas where the speeds are somewhat below 50.
Councilmember McKenna.
Sorry, do you mind if I...
No, go ahead.
So that sign is also going to be visible from Main Street, though, too.
Yes, it will.
So how is it going to look 45 feet up from Main Street? I understand, I'm glad you pointed out the 522, because I didn't visually see that, but it's also visible from Main Street.
It's going to be about 10 feet higher than what you're currently allowed. But it will be up in the air. Now, the other issue, particularly digitals, one of the issues with digital distractions, and we expect this sign would be digital, is you don't put them horizontal where you're encouraging drivers to turn their head and look at what's going on over here. They have to be perpendicular to the road where you face it. So this sign, for them to put it up there to be digital, would have to face 522.
And is that specified in the code that faces 522, not Main Street?
It says it has to be perpendicular to whatever the vehicle that you're advertising to. So this would be 522.
So if they say they're advertising to Main Street, would that have to be a lower sign?
Then it wouldn't qualify under this type of sign.
Okay, thank you.
Now that is some of the rules on digitals, because it's important at least to understand them. The reason they're so attractive is now they're cheap. And the reason they're cheap is the Chinese are producing them in vast quantities. That's the same problem you saw in the solar industry, where American manufacturers are trying to create solar panels, and all of a sudden the Chinese just undercut them. The Chinese government subsidizes those kinds of technologies, and so a sign like that is probably $10,000. That's not a lot of money. Now, some of the issues on these kinds of signs is their light intensity. And so you see in the code we have a measurement of between what this can be in brightness versus what the ambient air is around it. Particularly at night, as it's darker at night, the signs should get dimmer, not brighter. Because very bright signs in the dark sky get really distracting. The other issue is how long the image stays on there if it rotates. And I think that the ordinance says 8 seconds. It has to stay on there for at least 8 seconds before it can flip. And then there's a measurement of the time between when it flips, how long that duration is. Another issue is if it's motion, and you see a lot of the videos do two things. Some of them, they have the streaming and the blazing and so on. And the other issue is they're actually video. Increasingly, they're being video. Is that they can't be Burmese-shaped. Burmese-shaped used to have a message, and you have to go to the next one to get the next message and so on. Whatever's thrown up there has to be understood at that moment so that the driver takes 30 seconds to see it, moves on, and is not trying to see what follows behind. Now, the industry is getting pretty sophisticated, and they know these rules between what's effective and not effective. All we've done is codify them for you. So even though, I say $10,000 would be probably this piece. It costs a lot more to put whatever the frame is to mount it, to do the construction and so on. But the point is, digital is cheap. And you can see it applied on almost everything. Now, one of the issues with the Planning Commission concern was, if you now define what they are, where is it appropriate to be? And so they settled pretty much that it's appropriate on SR2. It's appropriate, I think, on some of the mixed-use commercial zones, but it's not appropriate elsewhere. in the residential areas or on the schools or in areas where you don't want that much visual stimulation, where it's, you're trying for quieter. And probably the best advertisement for that is the mattress factory out here by the prison. It violates all the rules. It flashes, it's bright and bright for the ambient light. It's a good proponent of what not to do or would not be allowed under the current ordinance. Now, another issue with these kinds of things is once they're up, and then they think that they're free and clear. You never can get them again. Because most ordinances are written on size and placement, and if you meet those rules, you never see the city or the sign pops again. But with these things, with the issues of ambient light and phasing and so on, what we recommended is they have to renew every year. And if they get out of hand and they don't stick to your requirements, then potentially you would not renew, or you would require bonds, or you require something more significant to make sure they adhere. That's absolutely critical. Every proponent of digital signage says make them come back to make sure they comply, because once you turn them loose and you don't have some kind of compliance requirement, they'll go crazy. It's just too attractive for them to ignore any rules after that.
Councilman Pitt.
Thank you. So I saw in here about the single pole signs, and there were examples in here about how they look like they're just, well, they're too high for the pole, so they don't look great. So with a sign that high, because that's higher than anything we have, could that be a single pole sign?
Yes, it could. You can see what I've done here is make the pole
look
bigger.
Yeah, but under the code, because
it would be allowed to be a single pole.
Okay. That was one of my questions on there, because...
And that raises another question that the Planning Commission took up, too. It's not whether it'll structurally stand up. I think Wes Schaub, the tire guy, or Les Schaub, is the biggest violator of that. Puts up huge signs on a skinny pole, and they're structurally sound, but they just don't look good. They don't look like they're balanced. They don't look like they're really anchored, regardless of what the structural engineers would say. So mostly when you put these up, you try to put them in something that's properly grounded. And so sometimes double poles look better, just because, particularly if it's a pole, if it's a sign that's extended out, it just looks like it's grounded, even though you don't really need that structurally. But in some cases, some of these advertisers, where they think that this is too small, build very massive kinds of structures around this to get a presence. And the sign itself is not very big compared to the structure that they build around it to kind of house it and kind of call your attention to it. And the Planning Commission was concerned that there should be some relationship between the mount and the sign face, so that it just didn't get out of hand.
Yeah. But was that added in?
I believe they added some language to some extent to that.
Whether it's a double pole or the single pole is bigger, so it doesn't... Yeah, I mean...
Well, that they couldn't make this so massive just to have presence.
Sure.
Quick comment about the electronic signs. We are allowing them in the general commercial Highway 2 area, service commercial zones, and the light industrial zone, Fryland Industrial Park, the mixed-use commercial from here to 522 allows a changeable copy signage, but the mixed-use neighborhood commercial toward downtown and within downtown, there are no electronic video. We do allow the messaging, what's the proper term?
Time and temperature.
Time and temperature type signs. So we've tried to open up a good part of the community for the fancier electronic signs, but did not allow them downtown or in the mixed-use neighborhood or residential areas.
Now there is, and if you go through this design guidelines, there is one page in there that shows you what became of the old reader boards. You remember, you used to have on a trailer, you pull up a reader board and it was supposedly advertised as special of the day, and then it almost became permanent fixtures, but they were considered portable. Well, now they're not reader boards anymore, they're video screens. You can see them on cars and on trailers and on other things. And oftentimes what they're doing is for a special event, they'll pull them in and park them, and then that does whatever the band is going to play or whatever the festival is or whatever. And that's perfectly fine if they adhere to the rules. But increasingly, some of these are driving around town, and then they become very, very distracting, and the rules, and the ordinance outright prohibits them as being driven around city streets. They can be parked and displayed if they meet the requirements, but not otherwise. Now, the last piece in the ordinance is enforcement.
Sure, Councilman.
And thank you very much. I appreciate that. I just want to make sure that I heard correctly. So, downtown, you can do time and temperature, but that would be it, where you can't do time and temperature.
No, you can.
You can do time and temperature.
Right.
That's kind of a simple, a traditional thing in a down, you know, lots of small towns across the country have, you know, bank with a time and temperature.
Right. Simple, changeable message. Okay. Electronic.
But we're not specifically, not the big ones with the video and the
right.
and all the stuff.
Right.
The basic ones that you might even expect in a. So that's there. Okay. This one in particular, I think car dealership, and I don't know if we've actually said car dealership, but that's kind of the thing that I think of when I see that. Just thinking of where ours are, they are right next to a major freeway. So I had a chance to look at it earlier, but I can't pull it up now to look at it myself, or so the internet is down or something. So is there some setback like from the freeway or from, you know, if it's on a road that's compliant, but a road that's not compliant, kind of like me, you know, certainly perpendicular. I understand you could, you know, here's the angle of the road, so it has to be at this angle. There's a setback from.
There's two setbacks. One is from Main Street, and that would be 5 feet. But I can't remember what the setback is here, but I think you can see it's about 15 feet, because otherwise you don't want this right.
You don't want to hang off the road, exactly. Which is
well, it couldn't hang over the road, but you don't want it right there at the edge of the visibility. Now, the freeway, you know, right away, this is really simplified, really pushes out here quite a ways. So it's not going to be right in the face of a traveler.
Okay. Which is good as well.
Now, you still have in the ordinance the issue of visibility triangles and traffic engineering concerns. And so the traffic engineer still has a role to play, even if they do meet the criteria, if he considers it a visibility distraction or hazard. So we put the formulas as best we can, but when it comes time for them to figure out the placement, your traffic engineer still has a say in that. Now, one thing we did not find in your ordinance was much language on enforcement. We didn't find things on inspections and on safety issues and on compliance with some electrical codes and so on. We also didn't find anything in there about fees or penalties if you don't comply. And you need those in the ordinance in case you have a problem. What you don't need is the perception that you're going to put a sign cop out and they're just going to roam the city and write everybody up. Because that's just not practical and that's not what you're really after. But when things get out of hand, if it's not in your ordinance to do something about it, you're at a distinct disadvantage. And the ones that are always the biggest problem are the A-frames or the sandwiches. And not just in the downtown, but out along the SR2 corridor, where all of a sudden they're basically out in the right-of-way. And so then the ordinance says if you can warn them, and then if they don't abide, you can confiscate them, and they have to come get them. And it also says in there that council reserves the right to specify penalties and fines. But we did not specify what those are, because we think council should have the freedom to do that by resolution. If you put that in your ordinance, then you're stuck going through an elaborate process if you want to amend them or take it out of hand. And so council can then set up on an annual basis or whenever they want to, whatever the penalties should be for noncompliance. And basically, you play that by ear. In most cases, if you have the ability to enforce and you start warning people that it's really getting out of hand, in most cases they'll come to you and say it's getting out of hand, then you have the ability to do something about it. The last provision in there is amortization, and that's another issue. You do have grandfathered signs from before, and one of the issues that the Planning Commission was concerned about is a typical language in an ordinance says when you adopt a new ordinance, whatever existed before is okay. But most ordinances have some time limit on how long you can go before things need to be brought up to speed. And the general default language is 10 years on a permanent sign and 6 months on a temporary sign. And so we incorporated those, but we also incorporated the opportunity to have appeals and variances in case there's hardships or in case there's some other issue that says, you know, it's not practical for them to conform at the end of 10 years. And again, you're not going to have
the sign cops going around and determining when things were built. When things really do get out of hand, and it's usually a safety issue or something that's like a rooftop sign, which is a problem, then there is a recourse that the ordinance allows for that. The only one we completely exempted are what we call historic signs. Those are the old signs painted on the walls of the buildings and so on. And the ordinance says as long as they maintain them, or if they want to recreate them in the style that was appropriate, they can be allowed and they can be exempt from the typical rules. That was a long introduction, so what would you like to know?
Well, first of all, on the with regards to the fee portion of it, or the enforcement part of that, I appreciate how that is structured. It really allows council to be responsive and much more flexible and pliable in their approach to enforcement, rather than having it as part of the ordinance, which is a much longer process. And oftentimes, I think it would have allowed people to really take advantage of the fact that it would slow down council's ability to act, knowing that it can take quite some time. So we wouldn't want those who are overtly out of compliance trying to, or taking advantage of that understanding. So hopefully council is appreciative of, well, but I think it did help to meet a goal and strategy that we've had as a city administration as a whole, to create processes that are responsive, flexible, and so on and so forth. So thank you for that, Paul.
Quick comment about the commission's work leading up to this, and then one late addition to this code you have. We did meet with the commission, I think, on 10 occasions over the past year. We had a public hearing at the end of February where two people made comments. One was Anique from the chamber, very supportive. The other was a citizen who was also very supportive and suggested a change of sign areas on Highway 2. But we did reach good agreement on virtually everything. There was they did forward a recommendation from their meeting last night, which I neglected to mention. 4-1, there was one dissenting vote because the commission declined to go back to consider reducing the sign height on Highway 2 and the sign height of the car dealer, larger signs that we were talking about, but the full support on a 4-1 basis from the commission. And we did make a very late addition to this code based on a comment from WashDOT about the Scenic Vista Act. There's part of Highway 2 and actually 203 now are considered scenic highways within the national system. And we're working out, doing some review with DOT and working out some details on that. And that will be any changes there or any other changes that come out of the meeting tonight we'll bring back for consideration for first reading, further discussion, whatever your pleasure.
Councilmember Pettit.
Thank you. You made a comment about the historic signs on the side of the building, which I think it's great that we allow those. I thought I read somewhere in here, though, if they had a commercial purpose or they were looked at as advertising, they were viewed differently. Did I misread that?
No, that relates to murals.
Okay, so that's murals, not historic signs. So that's
correct.
Okay.
And murals can get kind of sticky.
Yeah.
Some ordinances say that you can have a mural and you can have a commercial message inside the mural, and then you try to determine how big that message could be or not. My proposal was to separate those. Murals are murals. And if they're doing a mural in order to advertise, then you're going to get in a difficult situation, always trying to distinguish what that is. And I also advocated to you that the ordinance not include murals at all, because your problem is who interprets it and whether they're artistic or not.
Exactly.
Now, I put some good examples of murals in their design guidelines from Bellingham, for example. They're beautiful pieces of work. They have no commercial message in them at all. And they were commissioned by the city to be murals. But then the city council determined their artistic ability or not at the mural. But the Planning Commission wanted to encourage murals, and so they kept it. And so that's something you probably need to think about, and 6 months down from the road, see how it works out. My good experience is Bellingham, great stuff. My bad experience is a flaming, ghoulish skeleton thing out of Pasco that the guy thought was a mural, and there wasn't any. It's very careful; they didn't have any commercial message in it, and there wasn't any guidelines to determine its artistic content, and they were stuck. It looks like his whole building is going up in flames, and that's what he wanted because it, you know, gave him presence. So that's really up to you to decide how to deal with that. That's not an easy one.
So it is in there about murals, and by not having it in there, though, does it do what you had said before, you know, then it leaves it open and we don't have any regulation about it?
Then that's difficult. Some communities, where they have arts commissions, have gone that route and said works of art are subject to them and subject to council approval. The problem when it's in an ordinance can allow it. That's not the issue. The issue is its content and its artistic impact.
Okay. Yeah, we have a great one downtown with the Coca-Cola.
It's on that old building.
It's really well done, and it's great.
So. Is it historic?
It looks like it would be exempt,
and you would be allowed to keep it as long as they stuck true to the historical character of it.
Sure. So the enforcement, since it's not really in the code, what do you suggest are next steps of looking at enforcing this? Because what I've been told, we have a sign code currently, but we're not really enforcing it, or it hasn't been. I mean, you look around, there's sandwich boards everywhere. You drive through the Frylands, just as bad as Main Street or anywhere else in the industrial park. Temporary signs, balloons that have been there for probably years. So did the Planning Commission, or did you have a suggestion on enforcement and how to go about doing it?
There is an enforcement provision in there.
Okay.
And there are the only issues that we decided on enforcement was not to get specific. So fines and penalties are left to the council, and it's left to the city to determine who would be the enforcer, rather than naming that to be a planning official or a building official or so on. It just says the city shall enforce, which leaves you open to using the police if you want, or the engineer, or whoever you decide if you decide to do that. Now, when this is adopted, all temporary signs, the A-frames and so on, become non-conforming in 6 months. So what you would be doing is just saying, when we adopt this, 6 months from now, you can't have an A-frame on Fryland. You can't have these product placement banners hanging from your buildings and so on, and anywhere in the city. And at the end of you just kind of goodwill tell everybody that's going to be the rules. And on the day after the 6 months, you send Guido up. And he just pulls the signs down everywhere.
And I guess that was my comment. I saw that part in there, and you mentioned it earlier, but there was no detail around it. Maybe that's a logistics that city staff look at and go, how are we
going to do it?
Who's the manpower? Who is it going to be? Because we don't have that person currently.
No, well, it doesn't say. It allows you to designate where you want to, and it can vary.
Sure.
Now, there was one major provision that we made, and that's to protect the property and the business owner as much as you. A lot of times, if you're a franchise, the franchise will send you these banners that are product-oriented. Drink Coke, or you know, the price is cheaper for Coke. And it's not promoting the business, it's promoting the product that the main retailer sells. And the agreements between the franchisers and the parent company is that if they get these from the parent company, they have to put them up. So your ordinance says explicitly you cannot have product-only advertising. It has to be related to the business. So even if you're a McDonald's, you can't put up just a McDonald's product sign. It has to be something related to the business of McDonald's in Monroe. And then that allows the franchisee to tell the parent company, I'm not allowed to do that in this city. Otherwise, he's stuck in a hard place. You can see them there. And although they're called temporary, I bet you can find some that have been up there forever.
And one last question. You mentioned about the design guidelines that there's some bad signs that meet regulations, the height and the size, and then there's other good, you know, or bad signs that look better but don't meet the regulations. And we have the guidelines, and we have good pictures. Thank you for those, because that really helps kind of take a look at what is considered, you know, desirable or not. But how do you, you know, these are guidelines, so as long as they meet the height, size, all of that in the zoned area where they're allowed, these guidelines, these pictures are just more suggestions.
Yes, for two reasons. If you try to codify design guidelines, you're going to get in a problem that in order to get a formula down that's consistent, you basically do away with creativity. And so the argument is rather than creating high quality, you create mediocrity, because that's what a formula is going to do. On the other hand, any designer, when they come into town, want to know what the state of the art of the town is, because that's what the client's usually going to want to say. I don't want to get any more investment than I have to. Now, in practical terms, quality doesn't cost you anything. You're thinking more about it than anything else, and you hire a designer. But the design guidelines are saying this is what we consider state of the art, equal or better. Now, if they come in with something just horrible looking, you say, yeah, it looks horrible, but the industry will punish itself more or less if you put up bad signs. It's not practical or realistic for you to try to get in the business of, quote, creating an aesthetic hop. Every time that's been tried, they run into problems. The most famous is Issaquah. And Issaquah's was basically, I'll know it when I see it. And the court said that's just not specific enough. And so they kept trying to make it more and more and more specific, and then finally Issaquah said, there's just no way we can come up with formulas that are going to tell us we're going to get a good product. Because as I said, a good designer, the ban used to be neon. But you can see there's some great neon stuff in there that would even fit in the historic downtown if it's done well and well designed. The next big bane used to be can signs. That's where it's just a plastic thing put over a fluorescent tube. But you can see in there, there's some really creative stuff that's been done with that. So probably the most effective thing was to put in front of them, this is what we think good design is, this is what our ethos is in Monroe. Surely you can do this good or better. And if you simply don't have a good idea, look at what somebody else has tried and at least try to emulate that.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think the guidelines will give staff a good guide and a good tool to work with customers that come in, and it'll give us, I think, enough information and enough ground to stand on to promote better signage. If I bring in a D-minus sign, we can very quickly turn it into a B-plus, just based on the examples. And these are examples. These are the stand. These are the. This is the level that we're looking for. And in the vein that do this, and it may cost you a few dollars more to put that sign up, but certainly you're going to increase your business. You're going to have a much better business image.
This won't cost more. I guarantee you it won't cost more. But there is some language in there of emulate and avoid. So you do have language, but you do have illustrations. And you can, if necessary, use the language to say, or guidelines say avoid this at least. These are things to avoid. So you do have job owning capability.
Jeff, may I call on you for a second here? You've had ample time to communicate, speak with the business community. We've had a lot of outreach through the chamber as well as individual businesses. What's the sense that you get from the community based on what we have here this evening? Something that they can live with? And
I would have to say that broad acceptance. I think there's a desire in our community to get rid of a lot of the clutter that's going on. That's a common thing. The problem that the business community has had is that they don't understand where the limits are. And so having a consistent code that's enforceable, and as I've presented the sign code to the business community, having that's enforceable to the state every time has calmed everybody down. We have, by and large made the code a more permissible code when it comes to a business being creative about how they're going to advertise their business. But at the same time, what we've done is we've put tools in the, into the code that, that allows the planning department to not only permit the sign and do it in an effective and efficient way, but also give the business owner the opportunity to strive for something that's a little bit better than average. And so, in general, I'd say the business community is very encouraged by this. I've had initial conversations with the chamber about maybe stepping up the game. You know, we've Tom addressed it. You can't legislate aesthetics. I don't know if you remember the pink pig controversy in Snohomish. That's, you know, there's three or four things that we avoided like the plague. We didn't touch real estate signs. We didn't touch political signs. And we really tried not to get into the aesthetic side of signage. And those are the three things that will blow up in your face the quickest. So in doing that, we've ended up, I think, with a code that's much tighter. And there's a lot of compromises that have been made. And I'll be quite honest, there's a little bit of risk involved. We're bringing digital signs into our community, and that's something new. And I think we need to be very observant about how that's going to be implemented. But in general, what I would like to see the chamber do is come up with kind of chamber standards for signage. So if you're a chamber member and you're a long-term business in the community, the chamber will encourage highest and best use of signage as a matter of pride, as a matter of being a chamber member. And that will be a long conversation, and we'll see if we can get that implemented. But I think that's where we get into the aesthetic side and we start really cleaning things up through peer pressure rather than through regulatory pressure. But in general, I'd say very, very positive. One thing that hasn't been addressed is some of the wayward signs that we have in town. Monroe Steak and Spirits, forgive me, Sally, but the Monroe Monitor sign, those are probably the two most obvious signs that are the Chamber of Commerce sign. They're all sitting on vacant storefronts right now. Those signs will have to go away. They don't even get the 10-year grace period anymore. Those signs are going to have to come down. The landlords are going to have to white-face those signs or remove them entirely. And what that starts to do is businesses change hands and we get different storefronts. It keeps the businesses that are alive and active represented with their signage, and the clutter of the business past, if you will be removed. So good things. Highway 2 is probably the most controversial and clumsy area. The large shopping centers have a very, very hard time with signage out there. And I think we're going to have some discussions with them as the code gets implemented and how they understand the off-premises monument portion of the code and that type of thing. But in the end, in general, I would have to say there's a certain amount of positive anxiety, or not anxiety, but excitement about the sign code. I think we're going to see some permits come through reasonably quickly, and I think there's some anxiousness out there to get poked up and start using it.
One of the things the staff has done over the last couple of years that we've all, I've reported to everyone on numerous occasions, is Paul's worked very hard within his department, as well as Brad, and thank you for both the input that you've done. They've created predictability in our processes. And one of the things that this does that I've heard from businesses who've had opportunity to review is that it creates a certain amount of predictability of what's allowable and what's not. And business needs predictability oftentimes, especially when they're just starting out. They need to know how long things are going to take to be able to be implemented. They need to know exactly what's to be implemented. So this provides, as Jeff said, and Paul, I think, allows for a little bit more creativity, but it does create a much better parameter for a new business or an existing business wishing to change their signage that they can predict, or in a new business application or a development application, you know, this is something that can be laid out before the applicant very clearly, and I think it's going to help a great deal, help the business a great deal in getting through the process and be able to map out what they need to do exactly, and understand how long and how much it's going to cost them. We've heard tremendous, responses or had tremendous responses to from folks with regards to the processes overall. I think this is just going to be an added value to the business community and ultimately to the community as a whole. As Jeff said, we get rid of some of this clutter. We make things more standard. People start to, I think, are going to start to compete and see who they can get, who can get the best looking signs, so on and so forth. It's just going to, it's going to benefit, I think, everyone. So, with that said, Councilmember Geary.
Thank you. Jeff, I appreciate your comments with regard to the chamber about best standards. I think that's a great goal, a great initiative. Why not have pride in your town? I'm fully behind that. I'd love to see every business do that. I know that is maybe a bit of a stretch, but certainly as chamber members, you're established here in town. And so I certainly want to say I appreciate those efforts. There was discussion about North Kelsey, and Paul, you kind of gave a different time frame for that. Frankly, the original North Kelsey sign code I found to be extremely overly restrictive, and still today you drive by and you can't quite make out some of the signs that you're going by 25 miles an hour because it's so small and so restrictive on some of those places. Is that what we're talking about here doesn't actually touch that? I wanted to... it sounded like you said that something was going to be we're going to pull that out afterwards and do something different. So you can just explain the time frame again.
Right. The plan was either as we adopted this or immediately after we adopted this new updated sign code,
right,
we would go back and remove Chapter 7 in the North Kelsey Guidelines, which is signage, remove that from, retire that chapter.
Because what we would be approving would supersede it.
Yeah, that the North Kelsey signage would be dealt with within this chapter 1880, not separately. Those design guidelines are now reflected or will be used in the new set of sign design guidelines with this new code.
So all in one place.
The only separate guidelines would be for downtown.
Okay. And I certainly appreciate that as well. Downtown was, that was intentionally separate like that, so I do appreciate that as well. So someone who has an existing sign, once this is passed, they're in North Kelsey, let's say they're at Kelsey Road Station, and they've got a small one now, when this passes and becomes official, they'll be able to, whatever the new dimensions are, they can go out the next day and put up something a little bit bigger that looks a little bit more visible that fits in. So that's what we're talking about here.
Yeah, I think it'll have a good impact on North Kelsey.
Absolutely, yeah.
And the point has come up several times, and I think it's worth repeating. If you really go out and drive and look and really pay attention to the signage, it's scattered. It's very ineffective because there's so much. It just overpowers and nothing stands out. So if we can reduce that clutter and reduce all those sandwich signs, it's good. The aesthetics are going to be much better. It's just going to look better. And I think those signs will be much more effective for the businesses as well. It's kind of a win-win situation. It may take some time to get to that. That's where we're headed.
So, Paul, Councilmember Kittle.
Thank you. Paul, just one last question about the Highway 2 going to 35 from 30, correct?
That's yes.
Highway 2. Currently, it's at 30.
Yes. Currently it's at 35.
It's currently, Highway 2 is at 35?
Yes.
Okay, so there's no change.
No change. Okay. Just to give you an idea, if you can visualize the next time you drive on Highway 2, the AutoZone sign at, I think it's at North Kelsey, that's 30 feet to the top of the sign. And there's a new sign, there's just a pole now at Safeway, right on the north side of Highway 2. That sign to the top of the sign face, where it's perching the pole, would be about 28 and a half feet. I'm not sure if there's anything taller than 30 feet out on Highway 2.
Yeah, that was my question. I I thought that was the highest that you're saying our code currently allows 35, so
it
that's
does.
No change.
It does.
Okay. All right. Okay. Thanks.
So, Paul, we're planning on bringing this back to council as well as opening up for public comment. And that timing is?
Next week. We plan to come back next week.
You know, I guess I could have put it on the paper format. The computer's down, so I didn't know what to do. Yeah, paper. Right. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Paper copy.
It is next week. Okay. Great. All right, any other questions for Paul or anybody? Jeff has one.
Mr. Mayor?
Yes, sir.
Just one comment or what we would like to do in the ordinance, if possible, when Zach drafts the ordinance, repeal the North Kelsey sign guidelines all at the same time. We have to do two separate ordinances, we will. The second one is a review period. And basically what we would like to do is 6 months or 9 months or a year down the road, force the reopening of this code, send it back to the Planning Commission to hold another public hearing, to find out if we did what we did wrong, I guess. All of us will look at this until our eyes bled, but there's something wrong in this code, I guarantee it. And I would just like to be able to force us to come back and look at it again. And do you have an issue with that, I guess, is the question. I think it's a great thing.
And Jeff, if I may, the reason for that is oftentimes in an ordinance or when council takes action, we kind of forgive about things. You know, we just kind of, okay, it's done. We check that box and we move on. And you know, signage has been a topic of discussion for as long as I've been involved and understood local policies. And so that's about 11 years now. And so to think that it's just that we've got the perfect version. Well, I hope that we've got close to it, but we realize that. We want to leave that opportunity for discussion open. And so by setting a date, say a year from now, 6 months from now, whatever that might be that council chooses, that will give anybody opportunity to prepare or to review and be ready to come back and have that opportunity to speak before the Planning Commission and council again. So it's leaving that dialogue open to the business community as well as to the community at large. All right. Well, gentlemen, thank you very much. Appreciate
thank
the information.
You.
Thank
you.
Well done on the presentation. All right. Well, I'm going to reach out to Jeff, Diane, and Brad on this next public for this next discussion item. I'll lead off here. I can't read the cover page because the computer's down, as I said, and I don't have the copy of it. But last week, late, during council member reports, I had mentioned to council that we had an opportunity, I believe, to fulfill what I believe has been a very we have an opportunity to complete a project here in town that has really meant a lot to this community in a number of ways, and that's out at Miracle Field. This is a partnership that began between the city and Rotary a number of years ago, and 4 years ago, I believe, 3 years ago, the field itself, along with the bleachers and backstop and all that good stuff, was completed. But the whole project was not finished in that we were not able to complete the restrooms. So let me just point out that Councilmember Cutterback and I had a conversation a few weeks back, and she asked if I might look into some potential funding sources so that we could complete this project, which has been long overdue. And I apologize to her and I apologize to others. That was one of those projects that just kind of slipped my mind, to be honest with you. We put it on the back burner and really hadn't given a lot of thought. But we did do some research. In fact, Jeff Sachs brought to our attention a potential funding source. And that's allowable through the RCW's state law. And so with excitement and anticipation, I asked Mike Farrell to put a meeting together between members of the Rotary Club and City. And we sat down and talked about, well, what was needed. So Diane, help me on the numbers here, but I believe the city has already had in its general fund approximately $50,000 set aside for the completion of this restroom here at Rotary Field. In talking
capital
with
funds.
What's that?
Not general fund, capital
funds. My bad. The Rotary had also identified that they too had about $52,000 that they had raised over the last couple of years, bringing the total to somewhere around $100,000. The need at this point is approximately $81,000. I think the cover sheet or the information says $75,000. But one of the things that we forgot to put in there was the fees or application fees, the permitting fees, which the city anticipates on paying. We did that before for Rotary Field. But we do need to put that in as a budget item. I think this is a great opportunity. And if council would consider using the sewer funds, which fund is it, Diane? The sewer capital?
Yeah, the sewer capital.
Capital fund. Which is allowable. And do you have the RCW? I don't have the RCW. I don't know if we put it in there or not.
There is an RCW that allows, because you're connected to a sewer.
It's in Chapter 35. It says that the city is allowed to make provisions for the construction and operation of sewerage facilities, and Municipal Research Service Center has indicated that that includes restrooms because that's part of the collection system.
Yeah, it's awesome. So with that said, what we have here tonight is specific to Rotary Field. But at the same time, I want to kind of keep this thought process in the back of your mind, because we've also had over a number of years the discussion with regards to a restroom downtown. And so while we're not asking for any action related to downtown yet, because there's some things that we need to do. As I said last week, the one thought would be if the council were to look at purchasing some property somewhere downtown to create a festival lot/parking lot, that may be a potential location for a restroom as well. So you're actually getting three in one, so to speak, there. So I want you to keep that in the back of your mind, understanding that the funding for that downtown restroom is also made available through the sewer capital fund as well. But tonight, I'm here to just propose and ask for some feedback from you. Propose to have staff bring back an action item approving funds from the sewer capital fund to help complete the Rotary Field. And our estimation based on our conversation with our estimation on completion is about the middle of June, if we're able to move forward in the next couple of weeks, June, July, which I think is a very exciting thing to be able to do. That's right in the middle of our busy season and so forth. Mike would share, if he was here, that this not only serves use for those who are using the Rotary Field, such as the Miracle League, because it will be ADA accessible and so on and so forth, but this really serves a much broader community as well, given the number of tournaments and events that are held down there at Rotary Field. Somebody even mentioned, I think from Rotary, that Rotary Field would be a great place for an arts gathering, because even if it happens to rain, it doesn't get muddy. And it never rains up here, so I don't know why they'd be worried about that. But having the restroom there now would be able to help facilitate different types of events. Today, I understand that if there's an event there, we either have the porta potties or they're walking in clear across Sky River Park to the main facility in the center of Sky River. So it's needed. It's been planned. I think it's something that the community will benefit from, both the Miracle League community as well as the community at large. And I'm happy to bring this to you for consideration. And thank you to Councilmember Cutterback for bringing this back to our attention. Councilmember Gamble.
Yes, thank you, Patsy, for bringing this back. Looking for feedback. We might feedback full support of this for anybody that's, I view it kind of as the crown jewel of fields that we have in our community. I've had the opportunity to participate with Miracle Field, and it's a regional facility from that perspective, because if you go on the Miracle League website, we are the only field, and kids come from all over to be able to play a game that many of us take for granted, having the ability to play. And then, to your point, Mr. Mayor, there's so many other things that it's used for. Even those sticks and balls that you guys play out there too. But beyond just baseball, I guess is what I'm saying. And it does limit it, because the porta potties only come after a certain time. So I just think it's a fantastic thing to be able to finish, and would just help even shine more positive light on the city of Monroe and our park system. That's my feedback.
Thank you, Councilor Geary.
Absolutely agree. Thank you, Councilor Cutback, for bringing it back. And I appreciate your words as well, Mr. Mayor, for that. The money, I just have one question about, and I can probably ask this next week, but I'll just ask it now. Capital funds, the sewer capital fund, do we just have, how does money get put into that fund? And you said there's $50,000 in there. Is that money that we have set aside to do X, Y, and Z? And
it's a combination of connection fees for new construction and funds from a certain percentage of the operating funds are moved over to capital. When you pay rates, you're paying for the system as well. So a portion of the operating revenue moves over to capital every year too. Okay. And we have a cash flow projection where we set aside so much for capital projects each year.
And so that's where the $50,000 would
come from. If I may clarify, we've had a standing $50,000 for I don't know how many years.
Yeah, and that's
if it's just been sitting there.
That's capital money in the parks capital.
Parks capital. That was set aside specifically for this. The sewer capital fund has a balance of about $600,000 at this time.
5 million.
Yeah, but we allot about $600,000 a year.
Well, that's good. I just want to make sure we do it the right way. In support, just want to make sure we're not going to not do something else by doing this. But I think it's I've used the field many times, and it would have been great to have a bathroom there. So, and so many people do use it for whatever particular item they might be there for. Bathrooms would be great. Downtown, of course, would be great as well. But as far as, I just think it's great that there's money, that Rotary has money set aside as well. Makes it really easy. So I think it's great, and I appreciate the clarification on where the money comes from. Thank you.
Yeah, it's interesting talking about the Rotary. I failed to mention that. It seemed like the answer came to us so easily, but even the Rotary admitted that up until this point, they didn't have the funds, that they had been building the funds over some time. And so even if we had found the funds earlier, would we have gone forward at $100,000 or $150,000? I'm not sure, but really, this is a continuation of a partnership created long ago, but now a fulfillment of that common to complete the restaurant.
Public-private partnership. Appreciate that.
Councilmember Hamper.
Yeah, I think it's a great idea. I agree with that.
Councilmember Ketterbeck.
Thank you. Mayor, I want to thank you for meeting and discussing this and the city staff and you for looking for creative ways to fund it. It's been on the books for 3 or 4 years, and, you know, it's time to get it done. So I appreciate your work on it.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Councilmember Davis.
No, I think it's commonsensical. It just fits. And, you know, if we've got that kind of money in that account, this seems to make good sense to do. So I'm on for it.
Wonderful. Well, we will then, unless any objections, which I don't think I will hear, direct staff to bring this back. And I believe that we will be able to bring it back in time for new business next week. So we'll do that. I just want to check. Mike was out today sick, so when Mike returns, I just want to make sure that Mike has the ability to get everything in order. Diane, do you have enough time to put what you need together in terms of presentation if we came and brought this back for next week?
Well, I think Mike will do the presentation.
Yeah. You should put the numbers. And
yeah, he's kind of how it goes.
Okay. All right. So we will then add this again for next week. Spread the word for anyone who you may know in the community. I'd love to hear from them as well. And then we'll, of course, leave it up to council next week whether you want to take action at that time or bring it back for another day. But at this point, we'll bring it back next week. Councilmember Andrews.
Is this something that the time is of the essence, and so we need to prep to waive a second reading? Because in the past I've been against those, but the time's of the essence, and I think for the most part we're in agreement.
It doesn't need to be an ordinance.
Yeah, it's resolution.
That was my question.
So, yeah, you don't need a resolution.
And I think there might be, so, and if I'm confused, I'm confused, but I think that Edie and I looked at this today and let the record show that Councilmember Camp is now joined. I believe that our first and second readings are geared towards ordinances. Mm-hmm. So not to confuse those with other smaller items, but typically because ordinances require public hearings and we'd like to have the public input and so on and so forth. But to answer your point tonight, if council wanted to make a motion to move forward, they could accept the fact that we did not have that portion added onto this evening's agenda. And so we won't. But we'll bring it back next week instead. All right. Well, thank you. I'm really excited. I think it's a great opportunity. And not only am I excited for, again, Rotary Hill, but it's one less thing that I think we have to stress about or worry about as it relates to fulfilling the need downtown. We just now need to get council to be willing to move on a festival / parking lot location, and hopefully some things will come together and we'll be able to do that in short order. Yes. Okay. Well, actually, we'll leave the draft agenda for next week or for next, and go to the agenda item next. Gary,
appreciate that. Absolutely, and I'll share. I think there was a 2 weeks ago I had asked, and I had appreciated Councilmember Camp's support for adding an agenda item declare our intent to let the Red Light Camera contract with Red Flex expire. Well, when it's based on the two advisory votes, it's very clear that this is not something that the people in town are anxious to continue with. And I think, like, now that we've had the end of our appeal, we're kind of at the end of this process. The only thing left to do, there's really no reason to wait and not do anything. Quite frankly, I think that just leaves more doubt about whether or not we're being
whether or not we are considered to be responsive to other people so they like to see. So we've spent pretty much the last 2 years getting hammered or getting throttled for something that really that wasn't really our doing. That we've had to clean up a lot of things over the course of the last couple of years. And quite frankly, it's time to be clear about what we intend to do with this. And so my intent would be to make a motion, and there was some language that was recommended, so I'd like to see that come back next week into an action item that we can certainly debate at that time, or simply just vote on. But we've heard clearly it's time to move on and time to show that we've listened to what the people have said. We've had the two biggest types of input you can have, which are advisory votes and what wasn't close. And in that respect, the will of voters is very clear. And I think each week that we don't say something definitive about what our intentions are, I think that only creates doubt and only shows, or could be interpreted as we're not listening. And so to that end, I think I'd like to see this set back. I asked about it a couple of weeks ago, and I do appreciate the support. I appreciate everyone's efforts to at least speaking about it tonight. And hopefully we can have that back next week to take some formal action on in whichever that side you might choose to take on that. Again, it's there's probably been more misinformation and more just outright lies, you know, told about this. It's just time to put it behind this. So we'd certainly love to hear what others think, if there are others in support. Bringing this back next week, if we're in support of having it back next week, then we can wait till that time as well. But those are my thoughts based on the information that we received today. Certainly, in my opinion, time to move forward with making a declarative statement.
Thank you. Councilmember Hunter.
Yeah, I'd like to say originally I was not, it wasn't pressing. To me, it wasn't a pressing issue, but in the last week, I've had two different individuals question the city and what are we really going to do, and I was actually kind of surprised, and so I'm in full agreement that rather than have to explain to individuals, let's as a city make a public declaration, this is what we're going to do, we listen to you, and we're going to follow the will of voters. And so that's my opinion.
Thank you. Councilmember Kim.
Thank you. I have to agree with both council members who made their statements in favor of going down this path. I have heard or seen statements regarding it, questioning whether or not we're going to listen to the people. After two substantive votes on the subject indicating their will, I think it makes more sense to let the people know that we do agree. Not that we do agree, that we have heard them and we do know what they want. And so it makes sense to go ahead with the resolution as we saw in the email. Yeah. And so if I understand correctly, this would come back at a later date. The resolution come back next week. So I think I
agree with it. Not necessarily as a resolution, but as a motion.
As a motion.
Yeah.
To the chair.
Yeah.
Very important. So I'm sorry. Yeah. Getting myself up to speed.
Yeah. No, that's fine. And I'm glad you made it.
Councilmember Davis.
Well, I have to agree also. And I don't think that we needed two votes. We got the first vote. I think everybody can agree with that. But there doesn't seem to be that understanding out there, or at least that public perception that we've got the message. So, yes, I'd like to put this to bed. And unless there's some reason that it wouldn't be a good thing to do, if somebody knew something that I don't know, but other than that, I'm all for it. So let's do that.
Well, Council, if I might just say something after Councilmember Kadovec speaks on your behalf, that would be great.
You get it at the last second. Thank you. I would prefer that if we are looking to put this to bed, that we have a all the information we have at hand, and maybe getting a report from the police and others. Obviously, the advisory vote is a big piece of information that we have, and that residents do not seem to favor it. That is one piece of information. I'd like to see staff report on it, how it's been going, what the budget looks like, just a full kind of report on how it's been going before I make a decision to just put it to bed. So I haven't seen it out in the press. I don't know what the urgency is right now to do it. So that is my feeling. But I'm willing to have a discussion. I'd like to see a little bit more thought put into it. We're elected as leaders to make decisions on behalf of the residents, so it's a representative democracy. Sometimes people don't have all the information that we have. I believe part of my job up here is to look at all the information. So that would include kind of an update on where we're at right now with it, how it's been going. We've had no update on it, and probably for good reason. But if I'm going to make a decision, not our resolution, some sort of intent at the end of the year, I'd like to have a full discussion about it. Thank you.
Okay, I did that same thing. Sorry, Chief. I saw you kind of thinking hardly or hard there, maybe, or the bright lights are a little bright. I'm not quite clear what information you might want to see from the police department.
I haven't seen how it's going with the company. I haven't seen a budget of what type of money it's brought in, what the tickets look like. Have there been any accidents at that intersection since we've been doing it? I mean, there's other information I believe we should look at when we make this decision to move forward.
You can provide information such as that.
We will do our best.
Okay. If there are any questions, we'll do our best. Okay. All right. Well, what I was going to say, just on your behalf, I wanted to thank you. I know that you, as a council, I guess I'm in the same boat, have really taken a lot of heat over this subject. I have assured and communicated to anyone who might ask that you fulfilled your oath when you said that you would uphold not only the laws of the state of Washington, but the ordinances and contractual agreements of the city of Monroe. And while it was not a fun journey, it was certainly a journey that you took and managed to handle very well. The realities of this was that had we discontinued this agreement prematurely, the city would have been potentially liable for millions of dollars. And so in the face of a lot of political heat, ultimately you looked after the well-being of the residents here in Monroe, and in doing so again, took a lot of heat. If I hear Councilmember Gary and a couple others correctly, what you're saying is that the citizens of Monroe, in I think what you use is the best public forum or
biggest public forum,
but public forum possible, and that was the vote of the people. 70% on both occasions, I believe, said that they want this contract to expire at the end of its term. And so based on that, I believe I hear what you're saying is that you want to assure the people of Monroe that they have been heard, and that you intend to fulfill, or at least some of you intend to fulfill at this point, that expectation. So with that, I think I heard that there were a number of council members who everyone at this point would like to have this come back. A couple of additional items in addition or to be added there, and that's information from the department. Gladly do that. And we could place that under new business item number 3 for next week.
Thank you.
All right. All right, lastly this evening is our draft agenda for next week. And so we we have the consent agenda items, the minutes, and the our bills. Under new business, the ordinance amending chapter 18 of the MMC sign code. This would be a first reading. We have the item consideration and possible action with regards to the Rotary Field restrooms. And then thirdly, under new business, we have the item for discussion, the expiration of an intent of council related to Red Flex Agreement. And then moving on to final action, a resolution adopting utility billing policies, which we've spoke about previous to this evening's meeting. On the long term, anything that council would like to see on the extended agenda that isn't already there?
No, I think it's good to go by in order. That makes sense.
Well, it's not part of the agenda this evening, but council, anything to report this evening that you'd like to share?
Thank you. I have one thing. My neighbor and a Monroe resident, Steve Jensen, was noted in the paper as winning a contest for designing a lottery car.
Yes.
I just want to point that out. I was pretty impressed with it, even though I don't do lottery tickets. It was just kind of cool.
Yes, actually, I am. Next week is spring break, and I'm going to be gone.
Hopefully, some more warm.
No, no, I wish it was, but every other year I go see my mother-in-law in Cincinnati, so I'll be in Cincinnati happily.
Of course,
this is being reported happily in Cincinnati.
So the warmest place in the world on Earth?
Yes, exactly. Having some good skyline chili, but with that, I know that the Finance Committee is meeting that night. You know, we switched it to the 26th, and we're back to the second. I just realized it, but it's staring me in the face. So, Mr. Camp, would you be willing to chair the Finance Committee on the second if we want to follow?
I'd be glad to. Weren't we going to have a special discussion that night? Do you want to move that out as well?
Well,
you can make that recommendation after the meeting, if you might.
All right. We'll talk about it offline. But I will not be in the council meeting until April 2nd. Or I'll be in big trouble.
Staff, anything to add this evening? Brent?
If you'd like to look at the council packet, the internet's back up.
Oh. Oh, awesome. Okay, well, very good. Thank you for the discussion. I look forward to, especially the one item next week related to Rotary Field. Thank you to Jeff for finding that information for us, for Diane and Brett for double checking that. Checks and balances there. With that said, the meeting is now adjourned.